Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you, Andrea, and for the to the centre for this award. Given the competition, given the cause, given the donors, and especially given the man that you've just heard, I'm truly honoured. My contact with Thomas R. started actually from a joke. So I'm going to tell you a joke about a joke. I was studying at the time psychology, and somebody told me of an apparently true, but I suspect apocryphal story of a psychiatrist, perhaps it was Tom, walking through the grounds of a psychiatric hospital and seeing a fellow fishing in a garden, no water anywhere, it was just fishing happily. And since we were taught in psychology, and Tom was in psychiatry, that one must establish rapport and gain empathy, in that spirit, the psychiatrist went over and said, "How many have you caught today?" And the fellow said, "You're the fifth." And he said, "You must be on the staff." And I think I learned, maybe from Tom, but maybe on that day, that if suicide is a cry for help, then schizophrenia is a cry for housing. And when I laughed at this joke, somebody in the group said, "That sounds like Thomas R's." And I said, "I'd never heard of Thomas R's." And my friend said, "Well, he's a libertarian psychiatrist." And I said, "Well, that's an oxymoron." Originally from Hungary, he's an American, and he wrote a book in 1961 called The Myth of Mental Illness, which I'm talking about 1965, I had not yet read. And I read it. And when I finished, I was reminded of Huxley's comment after he'd read Darwin's Origin. How stupid not to have thought of that. The logic is impeccable, and I've been teaching it now for 35 years. And I start the Myth of Mental Illness session by writing a simple syllogism on the board. And, you know, no student, or anybody else for that matter, has ever been able to invalidate the logic that if illness affects the body and the mind is not a bodily organ, then the mind can't be ill and mental illness is a myth. It just seems so obvious. But I have to tell you, we now live in a world of feelings, so that I often leave the lecture and have people say, "Well, the logic is impeccable, but he's wrong. I feel it is wrong, ergo, it is wrong." And I do worry not only about threats to human liberty, but one of the greatest threats, surely, to human liberty is the decline in educational standards, the inability nowadays to argue, a distrust in logic, the postmodern view that there are no facts, to which I would simply say, the trouble with the postmodernists is they say that it is a fact that there are no facts. Or they exhort us to believe that it is true that there are no truths. But after reading Tom's Myth of Mental Illness, I was myself involved as an industrial psychologist, as we used to be called, in the business of psychometric testing. And this is very widely nowadays popular in Australia, in which people against their will are made to do psychological tests, many of whom are demoted, denied promotion, or even removed from their jobs on the grounds not of poor performance, but of personality disorder. And I remember reading, I think it was in Heresies, one of Tom's books, that he defined personality tests as hocus pocus, invented by psychologists to prove that they are sane and everybody else is insane. The wide acceptance of these tests suggests there may be something to that contention. So I worked for more than a decade, inspired by, believe it or not, a single paragraph in The Myth of Mental Illness, in which Tom turned away from the study of hysterics, but the concern now with issues of mental health, or having an appropriate personality, or motivating people. And I saw all of this as a danger. And I've been, if I can say in my own modest way, compared to Tom's crusades, fighting against that for quite a while. Australia was then overtaken in the mid-1980s by what is known in my country, and I believe we have exported this to America, perhaps one of our more successful exports, a condition that ran through the public and private sectors in Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra called RSI, and this is known as repetition strain injury, or depending on your perspective, retrospective supplementary income. And there were literally tens of thousands of people falling like flies, suffering from pain somewhere between the end of the finger and the neck. There were, in Tom's language, no diagnosable signs. And I got drawn into this issue because a doctor turned up and said to me, I have in my computer 8,000 cases. Would you like to know how many have medical signs? And I said, I would love to know that. And the answer was 1%. Which meant that Australia was moving very quickly into symptom-based conditions, so that illnesses were now being diagnosed on the basis of communications and generally complaints. And again, this is quintessential Thomas Ayres, that one has to be incredibly careful, even if, with the best of intention, we start diagnosing people as ill, simply because their behaviour is upsetting to them, or more likely, it annoys and offends other people. Around that time, I wrote on this topic a book called Achieving Peak Performance, and since people thought it was about sex, it was a bestseller. Which on the Australian market means about 7,000 copies. But Tom's work continued because we, after RSI, had outbreaks of occupational stress. And often when I'm teaching in Europe, particularly to German audiences who can sometimes go much quieter than you are, I will break into an anecdote from my country, from the occupational health and safety field. And here is one. By the way, these always make the German audiences laugh, which is actually hard to do. I became absolutely intrigued by the fact that there were cases such as the Anderson Meatpacking Company versus Giacomo Antonio back in the 1980s, in which a gentleman in the meatworks of the Anderson Meat Company saw God and spoke to God, it is alleged, for some time, was then removed to the local hospital and diagnosed as suffering from nervous shock, which is somewhat too metaphorical, and was changed to an acute schizophrenic attack. He sued the company, as it turned out successfully, on the grounds that since he'd never seen God anywhere else, the job was responsible. The courts upheld that. That was appealed to a higher court and upheld in his favour. Now, I was indirectly involved in the case, and this is an example of how Tom's work has inspired me, because it seemed to be fairly clear to me that this case was decided on the basis of a complaint. And so when my turn came to give some evidence, I said, was the gentleman religious? And they said, oh, yes, he's a practicing Catholic. And echoing Tom, I said, well, why would a practicing Catholic be upset and complain about speaking to God? And I was disqualified from giving evidence on the grounds that I was frivolous. Do I sound frivolous? Well, sadly, today logic and frivolity are often confused. Through the 90s, I kept in touch with Tom through the 90s, having met him face to face, of course, having met him indirectly for many years, when I journeyed up to the wilds of Syracuse in winter, and I'm from Sydney, and it was minus 20, and Tom was gracious enough to come out in the cold night and pick me up. He'd just returned from a major conference in Phoenix, and forgetting the message of Tom's worship of concise language, I made the mistake of saying, and tell me, Tom, did the conference fulfil its objectives? And he looked at me and said, speak English. Just ask me what happened. We brought him out to Australia for a lecture tour in 1986, and I managed to lose $15,000 for the university because, sadly, very few people turned up. But I think the highlight of the session was when we went down to Melbourne and we had agreed that Melbourne's most famous psychiatrist would debate Thomas Ayres. We turned up and they changed the rules, and three psychiatrists were there to debate Tom. Tom gave his eloquent and elegant 20-minute presentation on the myth of mental illness, and the leading Melbourne psychiatrist after stood up and said, "I refuse to debate with Dr. Zars. He's a paranoid schizophrenic." Tom, being the gentleman, the true gentleman that he is, remained seated. I walked over and whispered in Tom's ear and said, "Tom, why don't you get up and say, 'Ladies and gentlemen, you have just seen a psychiatrist in action.'" And he said, "Oh, that would be bad manners." Which is a measure of the man, I might add. Since you're here tonight to hear Bob Hicks, who also, by the way, I congratulate for being a fellow recipient, I'll close with simply saying that I have published and hope to send copies to this institute a book inspired by your countryman, Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary, and also the great Mencken, with two co-authors. I've written a book called The Management Contradictionary. And this is a devil's dictionary applied to management. But as we were writing this over Easter, I found more and more Zarsisms coming in. I found more psychology coming in, because psychology does indeed dominate the management field. And so you'll find in The Management Contradictionary, which I hope you might all eventually buy, if we can get into this market, little quotes such as the definition of a psychiatrist: professional drug dealer and jailer, inventor of imaginary illnesses, something Tom has fought against all of his life. Psychology, the study of the ghost in the machine, used by managers to manipulate each other, and generally to which they fall victim. I'll risk a somewhat risque one from the book, since it's in the book, the publishers accepted it. Psychoanalysis, and I'm sure you know Tom devoted a lot of time to psychoanalysis, quite literally putting the anal into psychology. It is the greatest of honours to have come to this group and to receive this award, particularly given the fact that Tom was able to come as well, and I'm truly honoured. Thank you.